Christianity and Judaism. This is part one, titled Jesus and Judaism. This is the beginning of another series. I think it's going to be a shorter series, but we'll find out. And again, we're going to be doing a deep dive into history as well as into the Bible. Up front, I apologize for my slightly stuffy sound. I'm not sick, but the air is rather dry, and I think my sinuses are rebelling, so bear with me. That's winter for you. Anyway, right now, standing on the cusp of 2026 AD, there is a lot of hubbub going on around the Zionist nation-state, which calls itself Israel, particularly now that word is getting out about the savagery and the atrocities being perpetrated over there. A lot of people who not very long ago were pretty satisfied with the mainstream explanations as to the hows and the whys and the whats and the whos are starting to suspect that they haven't been given a clear picture of the situation. In fact, some are coming to the conclusion that they've been given a completely different picture than reality. When I talk to most people about this, both in person and online, I get the usual responses you're going to hear from most dispensationalists and evangelicals. And one that I hear a lot is the argument that, well, after all, Jesus was a Jew. And this is an argument made by evangelicals and fundamentalists to prove that Americans need to support Israel in everything it does. And it's also an argument made by opponents of Christianity in an attempt to prove that it comes from evil roots. Now, if you were to ask your average Christian what Jesus was, they'd probably look at you like you were stupid. And they'd say something along the lines of, well, he was a Jew. Of course he was. Duh. And you hear that assertion that Jesus was a Jew made in churches. You hear it on the radio, TV, movies. You hear him referred to as a Jew prevalently. It's almost ubiquitous. It's almost universally accepted without question. And the fact that it's accepted without question is dangerous, because when we accept a statement or a claim without question, we're setting ourselves up to be deceived. I mean, even the Bereans didn't accept the apostles' word without question in Acts 17. They listened, but then they carefully compared the apostles' claims to the Old Testament scriptures that they had at the time, and they were called noble. So regarding this claim that Jesus was a Jew, we need to have the same attitude, even if it appears obvious on the surface, even if at first blush the assertion that Jesus is a Jew makes sense, it's still a pretty big assertion, and we need to check it out. We need to understand the answer to the question of whether Jesus was a Jew, and that's the question I want to address in a large portion in this series. And, you know, a lot of people might think I'm nuts for asking this question and wanting to examine it. But I would invite you to hear me out, because if we're going to make these claims, and like I said, it's a big one, that Jesus is a Jew, we need to be able to back those claims up with hard evidence. You know, the claim that, well, my pastor says the Bible says so, that's not enough evidence. You got to show us the evidence, show us the facts, because this might be a crazy idea to some people, but your pastor is capable of being deceived too. Whoever your respected source of truth might be is capable of being deceived. We are all capable of being deceived. We are not immune to it. None of us are. We're fallible human beings. And that's why we need to dig into stuff and find the evidence. And the evidence that Jesus was a Jew must be brought up before we can accept that assertion. So what I intend to do with this series, or at least part of this series, is examine that question. We're going to crack some books. We're going to start digging. We're going to begin with the basics and work our way up. So first of all, let's just start with brass tacks. Let's look at the word Jew, J-E-W, as we find it in our English Bible today. Let's find out exactly what it means in both definition and in context. Okay, so in the Old Testament, Jew is translated from the Hebrew word Yehudi. The Strong's Concordance says of this word patronymically from H3063, a Jehudite, i.e. Judahite, or Jew, a descendant of Jehuda, i.e. Judah, a Jew. By the way, the word patronymically means a name derived from the name of one's father. So Yehudi would be a reference to the father of the people descended from Judah, the son of Jacob Israel. And Strong says it's derived patronymically from H3063, which word is Yehuda, which is the Hebrew pronunciation of Judah. So far, so good. Okay, we've determined that in the Old Testament writings, Yehudi refers to someone descended from the tribe of Judah or living in the territory or kingdom of Judah. Now, what about the New Testament? Well, the equivalent word in the Greek is eudaios, Strong's G2453. His definition is from G2448, in the sense of G2455 as a country, Judean, i.e. belonging to Yehuda, Jew or Jewess of Judea. So the Greek eudaios, just like the Hebrew word Yehudi, refers to a resident of Judea, the name of Judah's territory during the days of Greek and Roman occupation. Strong says it's derived from G2448, which is Yehuda, the name Judah, and G2455, which is Judas. And Yehuda is the Greek rendition of Yehudi or Judah, as is Judas, which we pronounce in English as Judas. Judas is just the Hellenized pronunciation of Judah. So Judas Iscariot was named after Judah, as was the Apostle Jude. It was a very common name when Christ was walking among us. So overall, we can gather the following. Both the Hebrew Yehudi and the Greek eudaios, the words translated Jew in our English Bibles today, were intended to refer to the people either descended from Judah or living in Judah's territory, thus also observing its culture and customs. Make a note of all this. It may sound kind of academic, but humor me here. It's important. All right, so now let's go over some facts about the word Jew. Now, these facts you can verify. You can study this out. I'm not just pulling this out of the air. These are facts. Here's the first fact. Fact number one. The word Jew doesn't occur in our English Bibles until 2 Kings 25, verse 25. Let's go ahead and read that. 2 Kings 25, verse 25 says, "But it came about in the seventh month that Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah, the son of Elishama, of the royal family, came with 10 men and struck Gedaliah down, so that he died along with the Jews and the Chaldeans who were with him at Mizpah." Now, this is in the context of the Babylonian captivity, which means there was a ton of history, biblical history, leading up to this point in which we never run across the word Jew in our Bibles. We've even gone past the dividing of the kingdom, the house of Israel being carried away into Assyrian captivity. Don't you think that's a little strange when you really think about it? Because we hear our preachers regale us about how the Jews were in Egypt, the Jews wandered in the wilderness, and so on and so on, but we don't find the word Jew or Jews in our Bible until long after those events in 2 Kings, when Nebuchadnezzar has carried away the kingdom of Judah into captivity. In the case of 2 Kings 25:25, the word Jew in our English Bibles is in the place of the Hebrew word Yehudi, which, according to Strong's H3064, strictly means a Judahite, which is either a descendant of Judah and or a resident of the territory of Judah. And in this context, it makes sense because in the Babylonian captivity, only those who lived in the kingdom of Judah, specifically Judahites, Benjamites, and Levites, were carried off to Babylon. All the other tribes had been carried off a long time previously by the Assyrians. Okay? Fact number two, and this one might shock some folks, but contrary to what many preachers might say, Abraham was not a Jew. Given the definition of the word, a descendant of Judah or a resident of Judea, it's absolutely impossible, and the Bible never refers to him as a Jew. Judah was his great-grandson, so Abraham couldn't possibly have been called after him. He was a descendant of Adam, Noah, Shem, Eber, so you could accurately call him an Adamite, a Noahite, a Semite, or a Hebrew, but not a Jew. If you'd called him a Jew, he would have been very confused. He wouldn't have had a clue what you meant. He would have had no clue what that was. Even if you'd called him Yehudi, the Hebrew word, for that matter. There was no Judahite in existence at any point in history until, at least biblical history, until the first son of Judah, his great-grandson, was born. As we read in Genesis 46, verse 12, the sons of Judah, Ur and Onan and Shelah and Perez and Zerah, but Ur and Onan died in the land of Canaan, and the sons of Perez were Hezron and Hamul. So Ur, who was the great-great-grandson of Abraham, was the first Yehudi, the first Judahite. The tribe of Judah extended outward from Judah's last two sons, Perez and Zerah, but Abraham was not descended from his great-grandson Judah. Therefore, calling Abraham a Jew is nothing short of ridiculous. Okay, fact three. At no point in the Bible is the Hebrew Yehudi or the Greek Judaios, translated Jew in most English Bibles, used to signify all Israelites. Very often you'll hear preachers and teachers use the words Israelite or Jew as if they're synonymous and interchangeable. They'll talk about how the Jews were slaves in Egypt. The Jews wandered for 40 years in the wilderness. God gave his law and covenant to the Jews. The Jews conquered Canaan, so on and so forth. But that's very wrong. Remember, Yehudi and Judaios only apply to the people who are A, descended from Judah, the son of Jacob, and or B, residents in the territory of Judah or Judea, which in the divided kingdom consisted of the tribes of Judah, Benjamin, and Levi. All the other tribes, either collectively, went by the name of Israel, or by the names of their fathers of their respective tribes, so Ephraimites, Simeonites, Gadites, Danites, and so on. The tribes of the northern house of Israel were never called Yehudi or Judaios, ever. Think of it this way. Germans are European, right? So you would be accurate in calling Germans Europeans, but can we conclude from that all Europeans are therefore Germans? No, of course not. That would just be silly. Europeans don't just consist of Germans. They also consist of French, Italians, Norwegians, Greeks, and many others. Well, it's just as silly to call all Israelites or Hebrews Jews. All Judahites were Israelites, but not all Israelites were Judahites. Make sense? Okay, fact four. Now, this may sound like semantics to some people, but this is important, so pay attention. The word Jew, J-E-W, did not come into existence until the 1200s AD, 1200 years after Christ, based on what we know of the writings of the time. It was spelled with an I, not with a J. Over the course of its evolution through the history of language, Judaios dropped the D as it passed through the Old French, and William the Conqueror then carried that language along with the word into England. In Old English, it was spelled in a variety of different ways, including IEW, IEWE, IUU, IUW, in probably about a dozen other ways, which were all pronounced you. Then you had spellings like G-Y-W, G-I-U, and so forth. Tyndale's Bible in 1526, the Geneva Bible, which was published in 1560, the Bishop's Bible from 1568, and the first edition of the King James Bible in 1611, never spelled Jew with a J. Jew with a J didn't occur until the 1540s, and even then it was kind of a fringe spelling, and the J was pronounced like an I. The spelling Jew, J-E-W, and the accompanying pronunciation didn't become standard until about the mid-1800s. So anyway, this haggling over spellings and pronunciations may sound a bit like semantics to some, but this is really important to know, especially given the implications it has today, which brings us to fact number 5. The words Yehudi and Judaios never specifically referred to a religion. Okay, in fact, the ancient Israelites didn't even have a name for their religion. They didn't have a category for religion. Their worship of God and their obedience to his laws, it was just part of their culture. It was part of who they were. It was their identity. Yehudi and Judaios were always racial or regional or cultural terms. And not until the 1800s, about the same time that the word Jew, J-E-W, and the accompanying pronunciation became normalized, with the rise of the very highly financed and very fiercely promoted ideas of dispensationalism and Zionism, was the word conflated with adherents of Judaism, which was not, is not, by any stretch, the religion of the ancient Hebrews. And I know that's a pretty big assertion as well. Well, guess what? I've got facts. So we're going to discuss that. Okay. Because it's important. You know, as we examine the word Jew and what it means and everything, the question of whether Jesus was a Jew, it's important that we take a look into Judaism. Because when you hear the word Jew today, and this is why I got into the details, the nitty-gritty of the word Jew, when you hear the word Jew today, you typically think of people who are, at the very least, part of a group of people who call themselves Jews and often observe the religion now known as Judaism. But here's what you need to know about that. No matter what preachers and teachers might say, the facts prove that Judaism was not and never was the religion of the ancient Hebrews. It was not the religion of Abraham. It was not the religion handed down to the Israelites at Sinai. It was not observed in the tabernacle or in Solomon's temple. All you have to do is compare the Old Testament books of the law, also known as the Pentateuch, or less commonly as the Torah, to the religious book of today's Jews, which is the Babylonian Talmud. The customs, the rituals, the moral code, the laws, the overall character of the Talmud is completely opposite to the morals and customs of the Old Testament Hebrews. In fact, the more you look at the customs and teachings of Judaism, the more you find things specifically warned against and condemned in the Bible. Now, the first seedings of Judaism did not take place at Sinai, did not take place with Abraham. It took place during the Babylonian captivity, when the Judahites were exposed to Zoroastrianism and dualism and so many other heathen philosophies, and they brought these ideas back with them when they returned to Judea during the times of Nehemiah and Ezra. And Rabbi Stephen Wise, who was the chief rabbi in the United States during the early 1900s, said the following about this. He said, "The return from Babylon and the adoption of the Babylonian Talmud marks the end of Hebrewism and the beginning of Judaism." I'm going to read that last part again. It marks the end of Hebrewism and the beginning of Judaism. So even Jewish rabbis recognize that Hebrewism, the religion of the ancient Israelites, was an entirely different thing from the Judaism of today. What happened was Judahites went into captivity. They were infected with Babylonian ideas during their 70-year captivity. They brought those ideas back home with them to Judea and began developing something different. And that something different evolved into Pharisaism and eventually the writings of the Talmud. In his book, The Pharisees, the Talmudic scholar Louis Finkelstein wrote the following: Pharisaism became Talmudism. Talmudism became medieval rabbinism, and medieval rabbinism became modern rabbinism. But throughout these changes of name, inevitable adaptation of custom and adjustment of law, the spirit of the ancient Pharisee survives unaltered. So what Finkelstein, this expert on Jewish law, is telling us is that ultimately what we call Judaism today is the modern manifestation of Pharisaism, which sprang from ideas accumulated from Babylon, not Sinai. This is important. By their own admission, Judaism springs from Babylon, not from Sinai, not from Abraham, not from Noah, from Babylon. And according to Wise, the rise of Pharisaism was the beginning of the end of Hebrewism. Hebrewism being the teachings and commandments God gave the Israelites, what Abraham observed. Rather than being based on the books of Moses, Pharisaism was based entirely on rabbinic teachings, which eventually became the Babylonian Talmud. Britannica.com under Rabbinic Judaism says this: Rabbinic Judaism, the normative form of Judaism that developed after the fall of the Temple of Jerusalem, AD 70, originating in the work of the Pharisaic rabbis, I'm going to read that again, originating in the work of the Pharisaic rabbis, it was based on the legal and commentative literature in the Talmud, and it set up a mode of worship and a life discipline that were to be practiced by Jews worldwide down to the modern times. Britannica is just confirming what these Jewish men stated that we read previously. Judaism is based on Pharisaism. It's based on the Talmud. It is not based on the Bible. It is not based on Hebrew laws and writings. It is not based on Moses. It did not really exist until Babylon. It didn't come to full fruition until after the fall of Jerusalem. I cannot emphasize this point enough, because the common myth today is that modern Judaism is the continuation of Old Testament Hebrew practices as handed down at Sinai. And I'm telling you, and these Jewish teachers are telling you, it is not. In no way. And in case you need more, let's go on. Here's the Universal Jewish Encyclopedia, published in 1943. Notice I'm giving you this, a lot of this, in the Jews' own words, okay? I'm not making this up. I'm not taking it from some random, quote-unquote, anti-Semitic source. We'll probably get into that word later in the series. This is from the Jews themselves. This is from their encyclopedia, the Universal Jewish Encyclopedia, published 1943, in its article on Pharisees, it says, "The Jewish religion as it is today traces its descent without a break through all the centuries from the Pharisees. Their leading ideas and methods found expression in a literature of enormous extent, of which a very great deal is still in existence. The Talmud is the largest and most important single piece of that literature, and the study of it is essential for any real understanding of Pharisaism." Here's the Jewish Encyclopedia from 1905. It says, "With the destruction of the temple, AD 70, the Sadducees disappeared altogether, leaving the regulation of all Jewish affairs in the hands of the Pharisees. Henceforth, Jewish life was regulated by the Pharisees. The whole history of Judaism was reconstructed from the Pharisaic point of view, and a new aspect was given to the Sanhedrin of the past. A new chain of tradition supplanted the older priestly tradition. I'm going to repeat that. A new chain of tradition supplanted the older priestly tradition. Pharisaism shaped the character of Judaism and the life and thought of the Jew for all the future. So here we go. There are a bunch more quotes. I don't have the time to read them all. But this is a handful, just a handful of quotes from Jewish sources and mainstream sources showing that this is historical fact. I'm not making this up. Of all the religious sects in Jerusalem, only the Pharisees survived its fall to the Romans in 70 AD. And from that point, the Pharisees carried their traditions and their teachings wherever they went, mainly southern Europe and northern Africa, and everything was adjusted to suit the doctrines of the Pharisees. The Hebrew priesthood was replaced, as the article states, with Pharisaical tradition. Again, the Jews themselves admit modern Judaism is the bastard child of Pharisaism, and it's not the same as the Hebrew religion of old. It replaced it. And Jesus himself called the Pharisees out on this. They had a habit of replacing God's laws with their traditions. So let's take a look at Matthew 15, starting in verse 1. Then some Pharisees and scribes came to Jesus from Jerusalem and said, "Why do your disciples break the tradition of the elders? For they do not wash their hands when they eat bread." Okay, let's take a little moment and think about what they said. Okay, first of all, you can study the Pentateuch from Genesis to Deuteronomy, all the books of Moses, and you will find that it contains absolutely no commandment to wash your hands before eating. Zero, zip, nada, zilch. Now, I'm not saying that washing your hands before eating is a bad idea. What I'm saying is that it's not a biblical commandment. It's nowhere in the Bible. It's nowhere in the books of Moses. Mark 7, verses 3 through 4 goes into more detail, describing the same incident. "For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they carefully wash their hands, thus observing the traditions of the elders." There's that phrase again. "And when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they cleanse themselves. And there are many other things which they have received in order to observe, such as the washing of cups and pitchers and copper pots." Again, no biblical law or commandment or ordinance prescribing these practices. Therefore, if we're going to think critically, we need to ask, where did they get these injunctions? Well, they say it themselves, the traditions of the elders. Not the law, the traditions of the elders. In other words, the Talmud, or rather the Mishnah as it was then, as the traditions hadn't yet been compiled into the Talmud. However, in reading the Talmud, we can find the following. And you can look this up. Mishnah Chagiga 2:5. "One must wash his hands by pouring a quarter log of water over them before eating non-sacred food, and for tithes and teruma," their word for offerings. "But for eating sacrificial food, one must immerse one's hands in purification waters, such as those of a ritual bath." And this next quote is from Erubin 21b. "Rabbi Akiba said to him, 'Give me some water to wash my hands.' 'It will not suffice for drinking,' the other complained. 'Will it suffice for washing your hands?' 'What can I do?' the former replied. 'For when neglecting the words of the rabbis, one deserves death. It is better that I myself should die than that I transgress against the opinion of my colleagues.'" Okay, so going back to Matthew 15, the Pharisees are asking Jesus why his disciples are breaking these Talmudic traditions, not Mosaic laws, not biblical commandments, that are oh so important to them, these traditions that, according to Erubin 21b, make you worthy of death if you break them. Jesus says this in response in verse 3. Why do you yourselves transgress the commandment of God for the sake of your tradition? The Pharisees and practitioners of modern Judaism are all guilty of this. In fact, they very openly and plainly admit that they put the tradition of the elders, the Talmud, over and above anything God has to say. We'll get into that in a minute. But Jesus gives us one more example of this in the following verses. For God said, honor your father and mother, and he who speaks evil of father or mother is to be put to death. But you say, whoever says to his father or mother, whatever I have that would help you has been given to God, he is not to honor his father or his mother. And by this, you invalidated the word of God for the sake of your tradition. So here Jesus is again referencing the Pharisees' Mishnah and showing how the traditions of the elders violate, void, and invert the law of God, which, as Christ himself said, hangs on the commandments to love God and your neighbor, as we read in Matthew 22, verses 34 through 40. In Matthew 15 and Mark 7, Christ is calling out these Pharisees, these bean-counting, nitpicking, God-defying Pharisees for their blatant hypocrisy. And it's these same bean-counting, nitpicking, God-defying hypocrites who developed Talmudic Judaism, which is what modern Jews follow today. It's very important to remember this. Despite the propaganda, the Talmud is not the same thing as the Torah or the Pentateuch, nor are they in agreement with each other. Jesus Christ was calling them out for favoring the traditions of the elders, aka the Talmud, over the commands, the biblical commands of God as found in the books of Moses. And by the way, the five books of Moses, or Torah, which is the Hebrew word for law, is what Christ refers to as the law. But on the other hand, you have the Talmud. Okay, and the Talmud is an absolutely massive, downright nonsensical, and in many places, utterly vile collection of rabbinic traditions. However, Jews today will often refer to the Talmud as the Torah, because to them, the Talmud is their law. It supersedes all other texts. Jewish novelist Hermann Woke wrote the following: the Talmud is to this day the circulating heart's blood of the Jewish religion. Whatever laws, customs, or ceremonies we observe, whether we are Orthodox, conservative, Reformed, or merely spasmodic sentimentalists, we follow the Talmud. It is our common law. So, considering that Christ condemned the teachings and the practices and traditions of the Pharisees and their Mishnah, which led to the Talmud and the Judaism that is built on it, we can only logically conclude that when the Jews speak of their law, they're speaking of the Talmud. They're not speaking of the Pentateuch. They're not speaking of the books of Moses. Now, in the spirit of painting a more complete picture, I should point out that there was a previous Talmud known as the Jerusalem Talmud, but Jews give the Babylonian Talmud the preference. As we see in the following from Britannica.com, under Babylonian Talmud, we find this: Babylonian Talmud, second and more authoritative of the two Talmuds, the other Talmud being the Jerusalem Talmud. Produced within Rabbinic Judaism. It was produced within Rabbinic Judaism. Completed about 600 CE or AD, the Babylonian Talmud served as the constitution and bylaws of Rabbinic Judaism. The Talmud itself says that it is superior to the books of Moses or anything else in the Bible, as we find in Mishnah Sanhedrin 11:3, which says, it is more wicked to question the words of the rabbis than that of the Torah. So in other words, don't question the traditions of the elders and their interpreters and their teachers. It's better to question the words of God as found in the Bible. Rabbi Menachem Mendel Kasher, in the fifth volume of his commentary on the Talmud, wrote, "The decisions of the Talmud are the words of the living God. Jehovah himself asks the opinion of the earthly rabbis when there are difficult affairs in heaven." So he's saying, this rabbi is saying that the rabbinic elders are so much wiser and so much more authoritative than God himself. These rabbinic rabbis and elders who cooked up the Talmud and all the traditions, their decisions and their statements hold more weight than those of Almighty God himself. Hey, kids, can you say blasphemy? Anyway, so far, we've established that Jesus was, at the very least, never called a Jew. And again, people might accuse me of semantics here, but I hope you can see now why this is so important. Because when people think of a Jew, they tend to think of modern practitioners of Judaism, which Jesus most definitely, most certainly, most inarguably was not. Jesus was very much opposed to Judaism, the traditions of the elders, the Mishnah, the Talmud, and he was continually scrapping with the people involved in it, the people teaching it, the people who founded it. Matthew 23, for example, is chock full of his condemnation of the Pharisees. This is important for us to understand. Judaism was not the religion of the early Hebrews and Israelites. It did not originate with Sinai. It was not observed by Abraham. It was originated in Babylon, was brought back to Jerusalem, and developed from that point forward by the Pharisees. It is the religion and philosophy and law of the Pharisees, the very same people who plotted against Jesus, who persecuted the early church. And a little later in this series, we'll get into some of the teachings in the Talmud, and it'll become even more clear that Judaism is in no way an ally of Christ or Christianity. In fact, when we get to that particular segment, you're going to want a hot shower afterwards. It's nasty stuff. Anyway, my point, as we wrap this up, is that Jesus racially was a Judahite. By residence, he was a Judean. Culturally, he was a Judean. But religiously, he was not, and never was, a Jew. To say Jesus was a Jew is very misleading. It's inaccurate. It's downright false. He is not the same, at least religiously, as we've established in this segment, the same as the Jews of today. It's better to call him a Judahite or a Judean, an Israelite, or a Hebrew, but not a Jew. And in the next segment, we'll look at the Jews of today, and we'll look at the Judeans of yesteryear, and we'll find out if they are in any way related to each other or to Jesus Christ. Thanks for listening. This is TearingDownIdols.com, and I'll catch you in the next segment.